He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
This is Media Watch. I'm Colin Peacock. The Mail Online is one of the world's most popular websites, partly because it recycles the online journalism of other outlets as clickbait. This week I talked to Christchurch-based correspondent Anke Richter, who confronted them about that recently when it scraped one of her stories off the internet and rehashed it within hours. Also, can you really offset your indulgences? TVNZ One News ran a campaign this week telling viewers how to be more environmentally conscious consumers. But how good was the advice on travel?
Bring a keep cup and avoid plastics. Pick a hotel with a commitment to sustainability or stay with a friend. If you're flying, choose an airline with modern aircraft and offset your carbon emissions. In some cases, it's just a couple of extra dollars.
But first, the ACT Party struggles to attract supporters and voters at election time, but not the attention of the media. Its new proposals to beef up freedom of speech were heavily aired this week. But did the media give us a clear idea about the law or just crank up a contentious issue?
What we did yesterday is that we refocused ACT as a party for freedom, a party that wants to make the tax rate low and flat at 17.5%, a party that wants to give parents control of the $250,000
David Seymour, sorry to have to interrupt you there. We're just coming up towards the 8 o'clock news.
Just getting onto policy.
We'll get there another time. Thank you very much for your time, David Seymour.
That was Morning Report's Corin Dann cutting in on the ACT Party leader David Seymour on RNZ National last Monday, the day after the party's annual conference in Auckland. And there, David Seymour sounded a bit disappointed that the party's policies on tax and education didn't get discussed before the 8am news intruded. But he'd already been talking to Corin Dann for 6 minutes about just one of his party's other fresh policies, the one that got the media's attention this past week. Freedom of speech. And he can't really have been surprised that that ate up all the media oxygen around him and his party on Monday. It was the same just the day before the conference when he appeared on Three's weekend politics show, News Hub Nation.
The ACT Party will unveil its grand rebrand at the party conference this weekend, complete with a suite of new policies. David Seymour, the ACT Party leader, hopes it will transform his minnow party into a major political force. David joins me now. David, kia ora, thank you for joining us.
Kia ora. But it wasn't education funding or flat tax that David Seymour raised when given this open invitation by Tova O'Brien.
What policy changes can you reveal on News Hub Nation?
Well, we're going to talk a lot more about freedom of speech. That's something that at the start of the year you might not have thought would be a major issue. But you now have the government seriously talking about putting in place new rules that may actually allow people to be punished on the basis of opinion.
David Seymour said he was doing this because the Justice Minister earlier this year signalled a post-Christchurch review of laws governing hate speech and because of calls for curbs on freedom of speech from what David Seymour called the intolerant new left. ACT has proposed a private members bill to take out parts of the Human Rights Act and the Summary Offences Act, which he believes make people potentially subject to prosecution for saying things judged to be insulting or offensive. Now, later that day, News Hub trailed ACT's aim as a law change to let racists and rapists say what they like, which wasn't quite right. But at this point, it was worth remembering that ACT is a party of one in Parliament, and there's next to no chance that the law will change in the way they want. David Seymour's bill is a symbolic gesture to make a political point. But that didn't stop it being the lead story on News Hub at 6 that night.
Kia ora, good evening. ACT leader David Seymour has reignited the hate speech versus free speech debate.
The government's already reviewing the law, but Seymour says instead of toughening up the punishments, they should ditch them.
Now, reigniting debate was a bit over the top, but David Seymour's idea certainly sparked journalists and editors and pundits this past week. The proposal was high up in RNZ and News Talk ZB's bulletins after he unveiled it on News Hub Nation, and the news websites all seized on it too. And all this exposure came a full 24 hours before ACT actually announced the policy officially at the party conference the next day. Now, this had been billed in advance as not just another minor party get-together, but a relaunch. They even gave it a cool name, ReACT. And the Sunday Star Times that morning devoted most of a page to a preview of the conference. But on News Talk ZB's Weekend Collective show, Tim Wilson challenged the ACT leader on the lack of new policy, like this.
Kia ora, David. Hey, look, here's my take on ACT. It's a bit of a relic from the 90s. Sort of Kurt Cobain-y, grunge, plaid shirts, long hair. You promise this big relaunch and you come up with flat tax, which is an old ACT idea. It's nothing new here. What's going on?
Well, I think you're being a bit overly simplistic, and I suspect the reason that you said that is that you yourself are a relic of the 90s who loves Kurt Cobain and plaid shirts and would grow your hair quite a lot longer if only nature would let you.
And policy then took a back seat as the two men bickered over their 1990s cred.
Actually, David, actually, can I just jump in here? I don't want to fight it out over style. In the 80s...
Hang on,
David. Let's just back the truck up. I am a child who flourished in the 80s. My hair was longer than you were tall. And I'll tell you what, I dislike Kurt Cobain. I thought all that stuff was terrible. Very anti-grunge. Let's keep moving.
Well, anyway, I don't think anyone's that interested in your upbringing.
And then they ended up by talking about another innovation that the media picked up on, the addition of a pinky purple colour to the ACT Party's livery.
Okay, so no new name. There is a new colour. What's the new colour?
Well, it's funny. It's actually magenta. Some people call it pink. And the reason is that it turns out that in colour science, blue, yellow and pink are a trio that work. And we'd had blue and yellow for 20 years. We had no idea we'd been missing a whole colour, so now we're complete.
Now, colour scientists might say they're spot on, but most political scientists say the ACT Party has an uphill battle. It harvested just 0.5% of the party vote in 2017. That's just over 13,000 of the 2.6 million votes cast. And last Sunday's conference pulled a crowd of between 150 and 200 supporters. Last Tuesday, all of the stuff papers around the country carried an editorial asking this question.
Is the media guilty of giving a disproportionate amount of coverage to parties that struggle to get above a few percentage points come election time?
And in ACT's case, even a few percentage points is pushing it on their recent performance in the polls. But Stuff's editorial dodged its own excellent question, effectively saying that the outcome of the next election would reveal the answer. And it concluded with this.
If he can broaden the party vote, as well as hold on to Epsom, Seymour will have proven he's more than just a man skilled at grabbing headlines.
And grabbing headlines is surely a key part of the plan. The same editorial noted that ACT's promise to focus on free speech issues is likely to generate strong public debate, most of which will of course play out in the media, if this past week is anything to go by. On Monday, the AM show's host and chief editorialiser Duncan Garner seized on the issue like this.
What worries me is too often we see this overzealous policing of someone else's opinion by someone who just disagrees, and they're too easily offended by this, playing gotcha with the English language. They try to put a meaning on a word or phrase that simply doesn't exist, or choose one meaning and forgetting the others, of course. Suddenly, they're the judge, the jury, and executioner. So if I say a Chinese man stood in the queue to come to the country, they could cry, racist! Because I mentioned his race, his origin, his country, whatever. But if they say male, pale and stale, that's what, somehow okay? Come on.
But what Duncan Garner called the policing of speech online is actually just other people voicing their opinion in reply. And there's no law or restriction on that that's yet been proposed by anyone. And strangely, back in April, when the government asked the Ministry of Justice and the Human Rights Commission to examine how our laws balance free speech and hate speech, Duncan Garner seemed not especially alarmed by what the Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern had in mind.
So anyone who, and I think New Zealanders would support the government on this, really, to be honest, I mean, anyone who incites violence against a particular religious group or sect or whatever, I mean, you'll look to what banner, is that how it works?
Well, at the moment, it basically means that you're liable for prosecution. So we have, we already have, for instance, a harmful digital communication bill. So, for instance, if you disseminate images to humiliate, revenge porn, things like that, we already have legislation for that. We've got the Human Rights Act. We've got mechanisms already.
The Harmful Digital Communications Act, which the Prime Minister mentioned there, commonly called the cyberbullying law, is also something the ACT Party announced this weekend it wants to change in order to further our freedom of speech. It should only apply to people under 18, says ACT. And on the News Hub Nation show, leader David Seymour gave this as a reason why.
You know, what the Harmful Digital Communication Act says, you're not allowed to say things that are offensive. If you think someone said something offensive, then you can actually go and have that litigated through the courts. Now, just remember, Newsroom, a very important establishment in New Zealand journalism, has already had to face off a threat under the Harmful Digital Communication Act. I don't think that adults should be able to use it to litigate disputes with other adults.
Well, there was such a threat last year, but it was never really a serious one. Businessman and fundraiser Sir Ray Avery laid a complaint with NetSafe alleging that several of Newsroom's articles about his track record were harmful to him and should be taken down. But NetSafe declined to act on it, saying it wasn't clear if complaints under the Act actually apply to the media at all. Newsroom need do nothing, they said, while Sir Ray had the option of going to the district court if he wanted to pursue the matter, and he hasn't so far. And no one else has used the law to take on the news media since it was passed in 2015, so far as we know. But on hate speech, this cuts both ways. This week's RNZ website carried a piece headlined, "Muslim Kiwi Says Hate Crime Legislation Must Change." It was a story about Mepara Khan, a 30-year-old New Zealand-born Muslim who hit the headlines when she was attacked and racially abused in Huntley, and her cell phone video of that went viral.
Are you recording? You get the off.
Oi, I was born here. I've got the right to be here.
Mepara Khan went on to tell RNZ's Voices program that such abuse is not uncommon, especially for Muslim women who are visible and vulnerable in a hijab. And she went on to say this.
There's, you know, online bullying legislation, and there's some stuff in our human rights legislation, but really it's I don't think it's enough. There are massive gaps. We need to have this conversation and really figure out a baseline for what constitutes hate speech, what constitutes a hate crime. Because I don't think what we have right now is enough.
However, Megan Walton, the woman who assaulted Mepara Khan in Huntley, was convicted for assault and for behaving in an insulting manner that was likely in the circumstances to cause violence against persons. In RNZ's article, Mepara Khan says of our laws, there's nothing that covers discrimination against religion. And that was at the heart of a debate about the law in the UK 13 years ago. A legal defence for criticising religions was inserted into the Racial and Religious Hatred Act of 2006, following a campaign by civil libertarians and celebrities, including comedian Rowan Atkinson. Now here, some want changes to the law to criminalise hatred and vilification of people based on their faith, to follow a review of our laws on hate speech. But others will want to ensure that our freedom to criticise and even satirise organised religion and sects and cults is not undercut at the same time, and this may end up being the focus of the debate about changes to our law. And if the media focus on that, it could help. But if they seize on claims and counterclaims made as part of a culture war to engage the audience or to attract political support, it won't. Responding to ACT's Freedom to Speak policy, Duncan Garner told his listeners and viewers last Monday this.
But I'm for fewer rules. The rest is just noise. You want to see a country without free speech? North Korea. No thanks.
But of course, we already have legal restrictions on free speech in the laws of defamation, in employment law, and in the Crimes Act, with specific sanctions for inciting racial hatred. And even in the broadcasting codes, which Duncan Garner himself has fallen foul of when commenting on immigration. But we also have the countervailing force of the Bill of Rights Act, safeguarding essential freedoms of expression. It's not even close to being close to North Korea, where the state monitors and controls almost all public speech. However, 82% of the News Hub audience, responding to an AM show poll this week that was launched the same day, said, yes, they do think freedom of speech is under attack here in New Zealand. And it's not hard to see where they got that idea. The announcement this week that Christopher Luxon is quitting the top job at Air New Zealand has led to plenty of media speculation about a future in politics. But could it possibly be a case of him anticipating the Fliegskam headwinds on their way? Jeremy Rose reports.
There is a famous girl here in Sweden, Greta Thunberg, maybe you know about her.
Yes, a climate change activist, yes.
Yeah, and she is very engaged, and also her mother told last year that she's not going to New Zealand for singing. She's a very famous opera singer. And when she said, no, I'm not flying anymore, people thought, oh, if she can do that, I can also.
That was Swedish climate activist Susanna Elfors speaking to Public Radio International's Carol Hills back in April. And as you heard there, opera singer and mother of the better-known Greta Thunberg, Melina Ernman, last year turned down the opportunity to perform in New Zealand due to environmental concerns about air travel. The interview was all about Sweden's Fliegskam movement. The word translates as flight shame, and the movement is being credited with an 8% drop in the number of Swedes flying so far this year. Flygskam is probably the first Scandinavian word since hygge to hit the world's headlines. But where has hygge introduced the world to the warm and fuzzy Danish concept of feeling good due to the simple pleasures in life? Flygskam is all about bringing your holiday ambitions down to earth. In the last couple of months, the New Zealand Herald, Stuff and RNZ have all run stories mentioning Flygskam.
In New Zealand, we need to fly away, and our economy relies on people wanting to fly here. In tandem with that, though, is a growing number of no-fly pioneers, people who now simply will not fly in planes. It's really taken off in Sweden. It's called Flygskam, their flight shame. The leader of the Greens in Sweden hasn't flown anywhere since 2005.
That was Jim Moore last month introducing an interview with British climate researcher Roger Tyres, who had decided to travel to Beijing on the Trans-Siberian Railway for environmental reasons.
I spent 3 years of doing a PhD looking at emissions from flying. I didn't feel comfortable then going on a research trip, which is about environmental behaviours, to China and flying to get there to do it.
And last Sunday, Jim Moore again caught up with Roger Tyres, who was on his way back to Britain, this time on the Trans-Mongolian Railway.
Do you like flying? I mean, some people, I suppose, who hate flying might use this no-fly movement as an excuse for virtue signalling and so on. But do you actually like flying? You've actually given up quite a lot.
I must admit, I do like flying. I was part of the Air Cadets for a couple of years. My brother was trained to be an RAF pilot when he was younger. I mean, I think for some people, they don't like flying anyway, and then it's not a big sacrifice for them to give it up. But for me, yeah, actually, I do enjoy it.
Last week, Television New Zealand ran an item aimed squarely at those who were worried by the negative environmental impacts of an overseas holiday, but not feeling enough Flygskam to cancel them. Reporter Jenny Saw outlined the extent of the problem like this.
A return flight to London produces almost 3,000 kilograms of carbon emissions per passenger. That's like driving almost 15,000 kilometres in a medium-sized car, or the length of New Zealand 7.5 times. Return to New York is like driving the length of our country almost 6 times. Phuket, nearly 4 times. Hawaii, 3 times. Even visiting Brisbane or Fiji produces the same emissions as driving from Cape Reinga to Bluff.
And she ended the item with some helpful advice on those wanting to mitigate the negative environmental impacts of their overseas holidays.
In less developed places like the Pacific Islands, which struggle to process too much waste, live and eat like a local. Bring a keep cup and avoid plastics. Pick a hotel with a commitment to sustainability or stay with a friend. If you're flying, choose an airline with modern aircraft and offset your carbon emissions. In some cases, it's just a couple of extra dollars.
If only Greta's mum, Melina Ehrman, had thought of that. According to Air New Zealand's online carbon calculator, it would have cost her just $61.60 to offset the 2,718 kilograms of carbon produced by a single passenger travelling return from Stockholm to Auckland. But of course, the Flygskam movement doesn't buy into the idea that planting trees and flying somehow cancel each other out. Just as you can fly without buying offsets, you can plant trees without taking to the skies. And they're not alone in questioning the assumptions behind offsetting. Deutsche Welle recently quoted Pope Francis as saying if you follow the logic of offsetting, you would try and deal with the curse of war by forcing munitions manufacturers to build hospitals for the victims of their bombs. Pope Francis's view will be informed by the centuries-old debate over whether the Catholic Church's practice of allowing people to buy indulgences during the Middle Ages contributed to an increase in sin. There's no shortage of academic articles on the topic, with the majority concluding it did. But there are dissenters. In a paper titled The Economics of Religious Indulgences, economists Alberto Cassoni and Carla Marchesi conclude giving the right conditions, indulgences don't necessarily encourage sin. The promoters of offsetting are no doubt banking on that being the case, but the evidence is sketchy. In Offsetting Green Guilt, Yale University economist Matthew Cotchin wrote that carbon offsets pose interesting new areas for economists to study, namely,
could voluntary carbon offsets like indulgences of yore actually increase people's gas-guzzling, energy-consuming ways?
Matthew Cochin concluded his article by saying,
"My own view is that purchasing offsets is better than nothing. Yet when considering ways to reduce your own carbon footprint, you should compare offsetting to the more certain alternative of directly reducing your emissions. Reduce what you can, offset what you can't."
And if New Zealanders take up that advice and cut back on air travel, like the Swedes have, that could have real implications not just for the environment, but for the aviation and tourism industries as well.
Jeremy Rose reporting there on the media's new favourite Scandinavian word, fliegskam, or flight shame. Last week here on Media Watch, we mentioned that the New Zealand Herald has announced that they have more than 10,000 people now signed up to their digital subscriptions, which they launched in late May. And that's a good start towards the longer-term target of converting 4 to 6% of the free-riding online readers into paying customers within 3 years. But on his 9 to noon media slot on Tuesday, former New Zealand Herald editor-in-chief Gavin Ellis said, "There wasn't much good news in the biggest annual international survey of the media scene, which came out last week."
So I think they'll be happy with what they've got. They won't be happy, though, with what they read in the Reuters digital report that came out last week. Because despite the efforts of the news industry generally, they found only a very small increase in the numbers paying for online news.
But now that the Herald's paywall is up, the key to getting those readers to pay the premium is a steady flow of premium content worth paying for, including quality, original and professional New Zealand journalism. Now, an example of that was the fascinating and at times worrying article about Gloria Vale published by the Weekend Herald recently. This told the story of John Reddy, a father of 10 who left Gloria Vale after his eldest daughter was kicked out, and he was caught with Christian magazines that were not approved by the hierarchy there. The story of his fight to free his wife and the rest of his family, written by freelance journalist Anka Richter, was the main news feature of the paper's review section on the 1st of June. And only the Herald's paying premium content subscribers could read that on the Herald's website. But you could read a cut-down version of that online for nothing just hours after it first appeared in the Weekend Herald. It was on the Mail Online website with this clickbaity headline.
"I don't want my kids growing up in a tyrannical society. Desperate father wants his wife to leave Gloria Vale cult with their 10 kids, but says she is suffering from Stockholm syndrome."
Now, the Daily Mail is the UK's second biggest selling tabloid newspaper, and its online arm has been a roaring success based on it becoming a clearinghouse for huge amounts of celebrity and gossip stories. Dozens of them run down the right-hand side of the Daily Mail homepage, the so-called sidebar of shame. Every day, millions of people around the world go to the Mail online to get their fill of gossip. But there's also news harvested from all over the world, and with that in mind, the Daily Mail Online opened a hub with dozens of journalists in Australia more than a decade ago. But most of those journalists aren't generating original news. They're scouring other outlets for it and rewriting and republishing it as fast and as often as possible. Indeed, so quickly do they co-opt news stories that they often find they're very close to the original, and the Mail stands accused of theft and plagiarism on an industrial scale. The day her Gloria Vale piece appeared in the Weekend Herald, Anka Richter was horrified to see a rehashed online version of it on the Daily Mail Australia site, though she wasn't that surprised. It's not the first time this has happened to her and many other journalists. Now, with the Herald being across the Tasman Sea, it could be a case of out of sight and out of mind, but Daily Mail Australia even brazenly rips off stuff from their direct rivals across the ditch, like Fairfax Media and Rupert Murdoch's News Corp. Late last year, the ABC's Media Watch TV show put out a call on Twitter to Australian journalists who reckoned the Daily Mail Australia had ripped off their work. The response was overwhelming, and Media Watch devoted a whole episode to that on ABC television. Here's a snippet.
"The Mail takes from everyone, as you can see from this list of people and organisations, including the ABC, Nine, News Corp, Fairfax, the New Zealand Herald, and a bevy of freelance journalists like Ginger Gorman, who told Media Watch their work has been stolen. And its kleptomania ranges far and wide. The Townsville Bulletin tells us it had 5 stories lifted only last week. While in Melbourne, Herald Sun editor Damon Johnston tells us he's used to having court stories stolen on a daily basis.
They will take it within minutes of us publishing it and not having had anyone in court. And often it's repackaged and republished from someone in Sydney."
And, gallingly for Anke Richter in Christchurch, her Gloria Vale story on the Daily Mail Australia site carries the byline, "By Karen Ruiz for Daily Mail Australia." Now, if it makes the media so angry, why do they allow this to happen? And is there anything, in fact, that they can do? Well, the ABC's Media Watch show pointed out that some big players in Australia have tried.
Back in 2014, the editor of the Daily Telegraph, Paul Whittaker, had News Corp fire off an angry letter to the Mail threatening legal action. And in 2015, in another burst of outrage, News Corp did it again. But it never got to court, perhaps because what the Mail is doing may actually be legal, as the Mail claims. The key is the fair dealing provision in the Copyright Act, which says you can copy someone else's news story if you make sufficient acknowledgement, which is why the Mail credits the author and links to the original. So, that is one obstacle. The second is, the law says you have to sue on individual cases one at a time. And as intellectual property expert Dr. Kathy Bowery told MediaWatch,
the value of litigating for any individual work is probably not worth it.
Sad but true. And another problem is that the law is not very clear on what is actually fair, and no one seems keen to clarify it or toughen it up. All media organisations like to pinch other people's stories from time to time and don't really want the law to stop them. And all this applies to Anke Richter and her Gloria Vale story appropriated by the Daily Mail Australia on the 1st of June. There is a link back to the original version in the Daily Mail's copy, back to the Herald's paywall. But Anke Richter reckoned that wasn't a fair go from Daily Mail Australia, and she confronted them about it. So what did the Daily Mail have to say for itself to her?
First I thought, oh wow, this is making news internationally. So, you know, it's kind of what you want as a journalist, for your stories to spread. So at the same time I thought, oh hang on, they've actually just rehashed it, made actually two mistakes in there. Linking to the Herald, they did that, mm-hmm. but the Herald story is behind a paywall. So I was, you know, it was pretty clear that maybe it wouldn't lead to many more clicks on the Herald page. So yeah, no, actually, no, I wasn't happy about it.
Yeah, and indeed another journalist's name, a Sydney-based reporter for Daily Mail Australia, had her name on it as a byline.
That was the, I think that was the main thing where I thought, hang on, everything in this story has come through me and my hard research. And I mean, you have to know, this is not just the work I've done for the Herald. I spent months and months last year for a big report for New Zealand Geographic about leavers from Gloria Vale. So a lot of that work actually went into the story as well, the trust I had built and the information I had about others. So it wasn't just a quick shot. So I really felt ripped off, yeah.
There were other stories about John Reedy published previously, even this year. So his story and his family situation was not unknown. But it's pretty clear to you, looking at that story, that the journalist has seen what's published on that day and very closely used your work as the source.
Absolutely. They hadn't used any other source. They had another side. They had one sidebar, to be fair, where they had some general information about Gloria Vale. And I kind of wonder if they did that to, maybe for legal reasons, to say, well, this wasn't just a one-on-one rehash. But everything that was in the piece under the byline of the other reporter. I did email her and her boss, but they didn't read it very well. They made, like I said, they got two place names wrong. They confused Nelson, the city of Nelson, with Nelson Creek, which is down on the west coast, a few hundred kilometres away. They made a mistake about 10 of John's children being a Gloria Vale, whereas his oldest daughter had left before him. So they didn't even really read it closely.
Does the fact that the New Zealand Herald, which agreed to publish it, has its original journalism behind a paywall now to make sure they get some income from people viewing it online. Does that make it worse in your mind?
Yeah, of course. I mean, because, as you probably know, a lot of people, because the Daily Mail just rehashed sort of the bullet points. You know, they always have these bullet points at the beginning and they just go for some of the very basic facts. It means people who read that piece think, oh, yeah, they've got the gist of my story anyway. My story was 3,500 or something words long. All the work and care that I put into my long piece and my writing and the style and, you know, all of that, that's such a disappointment that people just basically get a condensed version that I would have never written in that vein. So it's I'm sure it would have backfired for the Herald and for people reading my original work.
I mean, not only that, the Mail Australia probably uses its own social media channels to put out that story, so they may get lucrative clicks and traffic and so on. effectively piggybacking off the stuff that you did.
Absolutely. Not the first time, by the way, Colin. They did that about 2 years ago when I exposed a pyramid scheme here in New Zealand called Circle, which was aimed at women. And they found that fascinating enough and, used the photos and basically my content as well. But at the time, I had bigger fish to fry, so that wasn't my focus at the time. But, yeah, they've actually done it before.
So what was their response when you got in touch to say, excuse me, you have taken my story? And, were you actually demanding that they compensate you?
Yeah, well, first of all, it wasn't as straightforward to just get in touch with them. I mean, to be honest, it was one phone call in London and I had an email address and I found out who the head of the Sydney office was and I wrote them an email and basically just invoiced them and said, look, you just took my story and I send them an invoice. Now I wish I would have actually done some research as well to find out what their rates are because I charged it based on my New Zealand rates. At the same time, I don't want to send them a bill that would clearly, where they would just put their foot on the ground and say, no way, we're going to pay that amount to you and we haven't done anything wrong. So I sent them a fairly reasonable invoice and they got back to me saying, well, we actually didn't breach any copyright, but still, sort of as an act of goodwill, we're paying you.
Well, when the ABC's Media Watch TV show did a whole show about it, the outcome of that was when they looked at it legally that, it's a bit of a grey area because the Daily Mail will often include a link back to the original story, so there's a form of attribution there. When the ABC team looked at it, they found there are a lot of journalists working for that outfit, but very few of them working on original journalism. There are a lot of journalists whose job it is to scour and scrape the rest of the internet for news and then write it up in this way where they believe they can fairly publish it. I guess you have some sympathy maybe with journalists in the position of having to do that.
Of course, and it's kind of ironic in some ways because, I work as a journalist, a freelance journalist for Germany. And I actually did my training in journalism about 30 years ago, this is how old I am, in Los Angeles. And that was pre-internet days, Colin. Believe it or not, we just had a fax machine. That was the new thing. So most of our work was actually getting some of the national and local papers, Los Angeles Times and the National Enquirer and you name it, all the gossip mags. We had them first. We had them couriered from, where they were published. And then we would just go through them and we would rewrite stuff for Germany. That was our main source of income. I mean, there were some original stories, but that's very much how it worked. And I mean, that was very tabloidy. But even for serious correspondents, let's say if you're based somewhere in the middle of Africa or so, you can't possibly go to all these countries who are in your district, so to speak, or in the area that you're covering. But ideally, you'd at least have a few sources, or you'd put a few things together.
And you mentioned that you'd written about, from a satirical point of view, about living in New Zealand. On your website, there's a copy of what looks like a book cover, a pyramid of sheep, but in that pyramid, one of them is a garden gnome. And you're going to have to explain that for us.
Well, that would be me, I guess.
Uh-huh.
It's a satirical book. It's like a written mockumentary about being a German immigrant in God's own. It was written in my early years of being a foreign correspondent here, which always sounds so big, but I thought, I'm here in the bottom of the earth, not much happens, and that was kind of the running joke of the book. I was a lot harder on the Germans in my book than I was on the Kiwis, but it came out the day of the Christchurch earthquake, which is kind of tragic. I think it helped my promotion in some ways because there was a lot more interest for radio stations and so on over there to interview me, and they wanted to talk about the earthquake, and then I had to talk about my funny book, and it wasn't always easy because, the earthquake, of course, affected me too. I live in Littleton, which was the epicenter, and then I had to pull off this, I'm here in a country where nothing much happens, and then that happened.
That's tough. But anything specifically German about the garden gnome, or were you just trying to show one of these things is not like the other, and that's you?
No, garden gnomes are so typically German. I tried to come up with something that, at least for the German readers, know straight away, this is a soccer. It's like the buzzy bee for Kiwis, something like that. It's a very archetypal Germanic symbol, but it's also very innocent. You know, it has no political stance or no political baggage, no historical baggage. So yeah, I thought it's better than a German shepherd or something like that.
Freelance correspondent Anke Richter, who's from Germany but is a long-time resident of Christchurch and whose stories are published here and overseas, including, as we heard, by the Daily Mail Australia, who had to pay up for pilfering and boiling down her in-depth look at life in Glorievale, first published legitimately by the New Zealand Herald earlier this month. Well, that's all we have for you in Media Watch this weekend, but the Media Watch team will be back again with Midweek Media Watch at about 10:30 next Wednesday night with Karen Hay on The Lately Show. And then we're back again with Media Watch at the same time next Sunday here on RNZ National.